Welcome to Come and See, your podcast for finding truth in a world of chaos. Brought to you by Living Waters Abide Ministries. With host and founder, Richard Case, and co-host and retreat leader, Kathy Riccone. Jesus reminds us to watch for the signs of his return. Today, we will explore further what we are seeing in our times that line up with what signs he said would indicate the potential of the end and his return. We will also discuss the practical meaning of this as we watch and as a remnant prepare as he so leads. And now your host, Richard Case.
Well, good morning, everybody. This is our End Times Friday, and we're excited to continue our second part of our discussions with our good friend Eric from Israel, who happens to be celebrating a holiday here in St. Louis, Missouri, in the United States, and Rabbi Ephraim, who was visiting his mom in Miami. So you've been in America recently, and you're back home now in Jerusalem, and our good friend Denny. And so we welcome you again, and we're excited to continue. Last time we talked about the events of Syria and the rebels taking over, which I have some more questions about, the ceasefire with Hezbollah and the return of the population back to the north. And then we talked about a deal of the hostages for Gaza working, and probably will be, maybe by the time this airs, it'll actually be done, which would be good news. But there was a statement that both of you made that there's not a rejoicing per se, you know, for a couple of reasons. And that is that maybe you have some temporary solutions, but the issue, it remains. And I was really understood this a little bit deeper. I actually, you know, had a lunch with Netanyahu back in before 9/11. And he was sharing with a group of us executives, we were CEOs. And he said, you know, life is different in Israel than it is with you. He said, you don't get up every day worrying about what's going to happen. You're living in peace, and you function in peace, and you function on living that life of peace. We live every day with wondering if today's going to be the day that another attack comes against us. And we and my kids and all that live with it. And you guys discussed, and we want to just briefly talk about that yeah, you'll maybe have the hostages released. Yes, you're having a ceasefire. We'll talk about Iran. But it doesn't really change the dynamic. And the impact is because of IDF soldiers. Maybe, Eric, you could start there, and then Rabbi could weigh in, is that there is pain with that because of what happened to these soldiers and where they are. So maybe describe that a little bit so our audience understands that, yes, there's some good things happening, but it doesn't really change the dynamic there.
So I guess I'll start by simply saying that I don't always agree with the prime minister, but I think those comments he made are fairly accurate in summarizing the situation. In my way of thinking, in this part of the world, the idea of peace is sort of a misnomer.
Yeah.
And its definition. What you can hope for are long-term ceasefires. You know, so in Lebanon, for example, we fought a hot war in 2006. So 18 years went by before hostilities broke out again. So maybe at the conclusion of these hostilities, if there's a Gaza ceasefire agreement and so on, we'll talk about Iran in a minute, that maybe we'll get peace for 25 years, you know, ceasefire for 25 years next time around before hostilities break out again. That's just the nature of the beast in the region we live in. And so that being said, there won't be dancing in the streets of Israel when our hostages come back, but there will be a feeling of resolution. That is, okay, this phase is now over and we can go on with our lives. There are a lot of, what both of us failed to mention in the last broadcast that you produced, is that although our casualty rate among the IDF and civilians was quite low, it actually was below even our expectations, I think. Many of us were preparing at the beginning of this war for our power systems to be out, our cell towers to be down, our water systems to be out. People were stockpiling water and all kinds of stuff, expecting this to be a really much, the IDF was on top of things and managed to really hit Hezbollah hard before these things could happen. But that being said, I don't know a single family that has not been affected by the war in one way or another. Either there's a son or a daughter who was taken hostage, or there's a sister or a brother who was killed in the war, or there's somebody. We have, I think, close to 8,000 IDF soldiers and reservists who are seriously injured. ranging from just a case of bad case of PTSD to losing one or more limbs. Before I left for the States, about 2 weeks before, as I put in one of my Substack posts, the son of a dear friend of mine who was seriously injured on October 7th was in intensive care for 13 months in the hospital, both of his legs. He suffered 16 bullets. This is an unusual case. Obviously, not everybody goes through this. And ultimately, he died. But many soldiers are dealing with serious, serious problems. And civilians are dealing not only with those problems and families with lost loved ones, they're dealing with lost businesses, because many of the families that were evacuated from the South and the North had their own businesses, whether it was a falafel stand or a supermarket, or they worked in, you know, a factory that was shut down. These families have suffered a lot.
Rabbi, any other thoughts about the kind of the attitude toward all that and the fact that there's good things that happen, but there's not a full sense of rejoicing with it because of the ongoing dynamics? What's your perspective from the spiritual side and from the population?
Well, I will just say that, I mean, the Jewish people are amazingly resilient, and somehow it's like in our historic genes that we keep on getting beaten, clobbered, decimated, genocided, and we get back up, and we keep on, we want to live. We want to live, and we want to love life and contribute to life and do good things. And so we climb back from everything. There's a positiveness and the great spirit in Israel and the Jewish people, I believe. But yeah, the toll is really, really heavy. I mentioned I came back this morning on a flight from Miami. My travel mate was someone who spent 2 months in a tank in Gaza. He spent about 4 months in the reserves, but 2 months was living in a tank in Gaza. And when they were in a tank in Gaza, they couldn't leave their tank because they constantly had people popping out of tunnels and shooting anti-tank missiles at them nonstop. This went on for a year. And he had friends whose tanks were blown up. And if they stepped out of the tank to go to the bathroom or something, then they were at the mercy of terrorists all over the place. It takes a toll on people. And two other people on this flight had limbs. You know, they were IDF soldiers who lost legs. So you just see it, like Eric was saying, it's just a part of life here. You know, we're proud that we're at least pushing it back for a while. I do want to mention that Eric mentioned, you know, the nature of the beast is such that we aren't really hoping for a real peace. And I just want to put the name on that. My son just walked in. I just want to put the name on that. And the name of that is radical Islam, you know, which is our neighbors have all sorts of different flavors of this Islam, which wants to destroy the West. It wants to destroy any value system which is not Islam. And they are trying to take over the world in the exact same way that they were trying to take over the world from the 7th century. And they have not stopped attempting. And whoever gets in their way, whether it's Christian Europe or Israel, which happens to be right beside them, they're determined to destroy that and bring about a revolution of the world where the world becomes Islamic. So that, you know, they have a lot of different flavors, and they love to destroy each other, because whether it's Shiite or Sunni or Alawite, or, you know, they're just like constantly destroying each other to get the correct type of Islam. But, you know, that is not going away anytime soon. And you just have to be really strong to defend against it and to be aware of what your enemy is. This is not a battle of land for peace, or it's not about any specific issue that they want. They want the world to be Islamic. We just happen to be their, you know, the closest in their face place, really bothering them.
Yeah. That's, thank you for reminding all of us of that. Well, as we look, you know, toward what's going to happen next, let's first of all talk about Netanyahu. I know he's going through a trial. What do you see happening with that? And will there be a new election coming up in the next, you know, year or two because of where he's at, or will he remain as a prime minister for a while?
So as you, in the polling, the polls are taken probably too much in Israel, but they come out regularly. And in the polling soon after the war, of course, as you might expect, the prime minister's popularity plummeted to very low levels. And the opposition rose accordingly, even though, to be fair, and again, I'm not a big fan of Netanyahu personally. I haven't voted for him and his party in the last 10 years, 12 years. But there were members in leading opposition parties that I would argue were also complicit in the negligence that contributed to the October 7th events. That being said, since from the last 3 months of the conduct of the war, which has gone much better for Israel, his popularity has increased dramatically. It's not clear that they would win election if elections were held again today, but he's recovered almost all the lost ground. These trials that are going on, from what I can read, it's my opinion that there are basically four cases that have been brought against the prime minister. And there are three of them that are sort of going through the machinations of the court system today, and things get appealed, and these trials have gone on for like 6-7 years. It's my opinion that it's going to be hard to convict him of anything serious on the current charges. There's only one. There's one where there's a submarine affair where he's being accused of benefiting financially, personally, for the purchase of submarines for the Israeli Navy. It's argued that there more were purchased than were necessary, and that he materially benefited from that decision. That is probably the only case that I believe has merit that will probably succeed in a conviction of any kind, if at all. And so I think in the end, none of these cases are going to stick. From what I've read, the judges in some of these cases have told the prosecution that they should try to settle out of court because their case is not strong enough to arrive at a conviction. Nonetheless, they go on, and elements of the country are convinced that the judges and judicial system are out of control, and they're unnecessarily taking the prime minister to court as a political move, and it's not really justice. And this ties into this whole judicial reform movement in a crazy way that will probably be resurrected. That's surfacing again as a serious problem in the country, and it's not clear how it will get resolved. We have a justice minister who was designated to form a committee to choose the next Supreme Court president, and he's stalled this for over a year now. And it's not because of the war. Yeah. It's because of he believes that the committee to choose the prime minister. In the United States, you have a system of advising consent. The executive branch of the government determines who they want to nominate to the Supreme Court, and the Senate holds hearings public so the population can hear the questioning and all the good and bad issues regarding a nominee. And then eventually the Senate either decides yes or no whether this nominee will become a Supreme Court justice. It doesn't happen that way in Israel. There's a committee that consists of existing Supreme Court justices, members of the government, one or two members of the opposition, and senior members of the Israeli Bar Association. And they decide who's going to be a Supreme Court justice, and they decide who's going to be this president of the Supreme Court. And this government wants to reconstitute that committee so that basically the government can decide without opposition who should be a Supreme Court justice. You know, it's another discussion to talk about the strengths and weaknesses of the Israeli political system. But I think it'll be getting off subject if we go into that too much at the moment.
Yeah. Will be out of this, will there be a new election in the next year or two, do you think, or will it just be status quo for the next couple of years?
The issue that may or may not bring down the government, in my opinion, is the one over the drafting of the ultra-Orthodox segment of society. There are two ultra-Orthodox parties in this coalition government who are demanding that the government come up with a solution that permits their constituency to evade the draft. And as we've talked about, there are many, many injured soldiers. There are reservists who served 200 plus years out of a 365-day calendar in the reserves, all because there's a shortage of manpower in the army. And to exempt the ultra-Orthodox, which has been going on now since the Begin government in the 70s, this is going to be a very, very hard pill for the country to swallow. And that may be enough to bring the government down, because the prime minister's party, the Likud party, its constituency, every poll taken, does not support at all the exemption of the ultra-Orthodox. So if the Likud as a party supports it, it could hurt them potentially in future elections. It's not clear, but you'll see a lot of demonstrations in the streets. Hopefully not violence, but...
Well, just on the BB question, I think it's important to note that although there are a lot of constant demonstrations against BB, and there's a lot of anti-BB sentiment in Israel, it is important to know that people have a lot of reasons to not like BB, but it does not mean that they weren't supportive of the wars that we have been fighting I think often the consumption, public consumption in America is they think, oh, people are against Bibi. It means they think that we are being too aggressive in Gaza, or we're not giving enough humanitarian aid in Gaza, or we shouldn't be fighting in Lebanon, or we shouldn't be bombing Iran. No, there's really very, very broad-based support, even amongst those who don't like Bibi, for the way the war has been executed and the national determination to try and cripple our enemies who are trying to destroy us. So they can be supportive of that and be against Bibi for whatever they see as either corruption or the ultra-Orthodox issue. So yeah, there's definitely where we've been very united because we've been facing a war of destruction that was, you know, put on us against our will. But underneath that unity, there's a lot of disunity on major, major issues, like should Bibi Netanyahu be the prime minister, and the ultra-Orthodox exemptions, as Eric mentioned. So as we start feeling a little bit more secure, and we're winning the existential battles, these things are going to rise up and cause a lot of difficulties in our society. And I'm sure there will be an election over these issues with pretty soon.
Yeah. And then
a quick question for Ephraim on this. Eric talked about the sort of judicial chaos and then the political issues with the president. Given the ancient history of Israel, the importance of judges, the importance of the priestly selection of leaders, does any of that carry over in modern Israel, this question of who should be leading the country and how some of this should work?
Good question. But I don't think it really does, because even the very Orthodox are not pushing for like a theocratic state. They're not, this is not like Islam, where there's actually, you know, major elements that want a strict Orthodox Islamic state, which enforces Islam on its population. The ultra-Orthodox are not out for that. They want to be able to do religion as they want. They want their community to be respected, and sometimes in ways like the army issue that not everybody likes very much and disagrees strongly, but they're not into imposing their view of religion, Torah approach to how government works on the rest of the country. There's a recognition this is a democratic country, and I think we're all pretty much okay with that. Now, there may be a messianic vision, there may be like a hope, a desire, a belief that will come one day, but no one is pushing that forward politically.
Yeah, that's good. What our President Trump being elected, what do you see as the impact and the hope of his interaction with Israel? What do you see happening there? What's the view of what they think is going to happen and would hope to happen?
I think there's a bit of expectations in Israel that the constant talk of withholding arms will disappear once President-elect Trump is in office. I've read where Prime Minister Netanyahu was planning on attending the inauguration of President Trump. And there's an effort underway, obviously, by our prime minister I'll use the word cozy up to President Trump and make sure that interests are aligned. And I think it's hard to predict how it will impact Israel going forward. There is some hope that something can be done with the International Criminal Court, which issued this arrest warrants for our prime minister and our former defense minister, which I think unanimously in Israel is felt is extremely political, anti-Israel, bordering on anti-Semitic rationale. I'm not sure what, you know, and my guess is that there'll be a deal with Saudi Arabia in the offing. It's not clear in Israel, given the haze of politics, how much the demand for a quote roadmap to a Palestinian state with a timetable is a critical issue to the Saudi Arabian monarchy versus the Biden administration. There are many in Israel who believe this is really an issue that's important to the Biden administration more so than the Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
But all that's in this sort of murkiness of politics and so on, and probably they'll clear up under the Trump administration. And so I think everyone's expecting there to be some initiative in this regard with Saudi Arabia. Hopefully it matures into something substantial, because it could lead to agreements with many other Arab countries in the region, or may not. And so I'm not sure what else we would expect to see from a Trump presidency. I don't know. Well, I think one thing we would expect, we are hoping to see, is a toughening of the stance with Iran.
Yeah.
President Trump in his previous term tightened all the restrictions against Iran when he came into office, and because he could make no sense of the so-called, what is it called, Joint Committee, JCPOA, whatever it was called, right, led by President Obama with Iran. He couldn't make sense of it. And so there's some expectation and hope that the tightening of the reins around Iran will increase.
Yeah. Speaking of Iran, who is really the source behind all their proxies, Hamas, Hezbollah, you know, Syria, Yemen, what do you see happening right now with where that's going to land? And we know that you're not talking about anything permanent, but what will happen in the short term with the dynamic with Iran?
I think that there's a fairly high expectation within the Israeli population that sometime between now and January 21st is the time, if we're ever going to strike the nuclear facilities of Iran, this is the time. And I think there's a large segment of the Israeli population who will be very disappointed to the range, to maybe to the range of being upset with the government if nothing is done. And that being said, it's important to talk about the tactical implications. The only way to properly destroy these nuclear facilities is by a B-2 bomber dropping, I don't know what is, the 2-ton bomb or something like that, that can penetrate these bunker busting, these facilities like Fordo that are very deep underground. That being said, Israel doesn't possess either the aircraft or these heavy bombs with which to destroy these nuclear facilities. That being said, when Israel took out Hassan Nasrallah, what it did that many people don't understand or appreciate perhaps is that the Israeli Air Force, with incredible precision, managed to drop a bomb over the area where a bunker was for Nasrallah. And 10 seconds later, a second fighter jet dropped the second bomb. And 10 seconds later, a third fighter jet dropped the third bomb. And this went on 5 or 6 times until they could, because you need to drop the bomb. And before the earth could cover back up where, you know, it can fall on itself, you need to deliver the second bomb. So it can deeply. Did this with incredible precision. And that's how it assassinated Nasrallah. That same tactic, I believe, although I'm not a military expert, could be used to destroy the nuclear facilities in Iran. But now we're executing this maneuver, you know, several thousand miles away. And so it's much more difficult. That being said, because of Israel's previous actions, virtually all the air defenses of Iran were taken out. Now, why is that important? The top air fighter jets of Israel, including the F-35s, bought from the United States, were sufficiently stealth-like that Iran could not detect them, and they could not take them out with their Russian-made anti-aircraft missiles. With everything taken out, even a drone sent in by Israel can go undetected no fear of being destroyed entering Iranian airspace. So there are many other tools that Israel Air Force could use to destroy them. But I think there's a general feeling within the Israeli society that this is the time. If we're ever going to do it, now is the time. And my guess is if it gets done, it'll be done the first half of January, simply because they'll want to get it done before the Biden administration can launch anything in the UN that would hurt Israel.
Yep. That's good. Well, thank you. We're at the end of our time, but thank you so much. It'll be interesting because obviously we'll find out what happens. And we want to talk further about, as you see things coming about, what will that mean over the next year or two? And what are the keys to what keep watching? So thank you so much for that insight. And we wish you well. And Eric, we hope you have a happy trip holiday here in the United States with your friends and relatives. And Rabbi, we wish you happy Hanukkah. That you will enjoy.
Merry Christmas to all your listeners.
Yeah, thank you. Merry Christmas to us.
Merry Christmas.
And do you personally with your family celebrate? It goes on 8 days, right? The Hanukkah.
Yeah, we have 8 days of celebrations, and I have 9 kids, so it actually works out really nicely.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, that's great. Well, thank you so much, and we will look forward to catching up again. And it's been so helpful. And Denny, thank you for your relationship here and your great thoughts to help us prepare for this. So, thank you so much. So we'll see you guys. Hope you have a good December and end January.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for joining us, everyone. If you have questions from today's broadcast, send them in to us at questions@abideministries.com. And we look forward to seeing you next time.
Yep. We'll see you then.
Thank you for joining us for today's episode of Come and See, your podcast for truth in a world of chaos. Brought to you by Living Waters Abide Ministries. Send us your questions and comments and tune in tomorrow for more answers to your personal questions about living life in God's truth. Remember, God's will is best and none better. His truth brings peace in this world of chaos.